We raised you to be better than that.
It really sounds that awful to you? Us together, a little baby?
She crimped the edge of the magazine with her fingernails.
I thought you wanted us to stay together forever.
I do. Maybe. Lex, we're 18. You know what people would say? Everybody would say, oh, look, another black kid knocked a girl up before he even graduated from high school. More teen parents. Probably going to drop out now. That's what everybody would say.
He shut his book and tossed it onto the table.
No way am I going to be that guy. No way.
Okay.
Lexi shut her eyes and hoped Brian wouldn't notice.
I didn't say let's have kids right now, you know. I'm just imagining. Just trying to picture what the future might be like is all.
Hard as it was to admit, she knew he was right. In Shaker, high schoolers did not have babies. They took AP classes. They went to college. In eighth grade, everyone had said Carrie Wilson was pregnant. Her boyfriend, it was well known, was 17 and a dropout from Cleveland Heights. And Tiana Jones, Carrie's best friend, had confirmed to several people that it was true. Carrie spent several weeks looking smug and mysterious, rubbing her hand on her belly, before Mr. Avangard, the vice principal, called an assembly to address the entire grade.
"I understand there are rumors flying," he said, glaring out at the crowd.
The faces looked so young to him. Braces, acne, retainers, the very first bristles of a beard.
"These children," he thought, "they think it's all a joke." "No one is pregnant," he told them. "I know that none of you young ladies and gentlemen would be that irresponsible."
And indeed, as weeks passed, Carrie Wilson's stomach remained as flat as ever, and people eventually forgot all about it. In Shaker Heights, either teens did not get pregnant, or they did an exceptionally good job of hiding it. Because what would people say? Slut. That's what the kids at school would say. Ho, even though she and Brian were 18 and therefore legally adults, even though they had been together for so long. The neighbors? Probably nothing, not when she walked by with her belly swollen or pushing a stroller. But when she'd gone inside, they'd all talk. Her mother would be mortified. There'd be shame, and there would be pity. And Lexi knew she was not equipped to withstand either one. There was only one thing to do then. She curled up on the bed, feeling small and pink and tender as a cocktail shrimp, and let her fantasy go, like a balloon soaring into the sky until it burst. At dinner that night, Mrs. Richardson announced her plan to visit Pittsburgh for research, she told everyone. A story on zebra mussels in Lake Erie, and you know Pittsburgh has had its own problems with invasive wildlife. She thought carefully about a plausible excuse and, after much thought, had come up with a topic that no one would have questions about. As she'd expected, no one paid much attention, except Lexi, who briefly closed her eyes and whispered a silent thanks to whatever deity had made this happen. The next morning, Lexi pretended to be running late, but once everyone had gone, she checked to be sure the house was empty before dialing the number to a local clinic, which she had looked up the night before.
"The 11th. She told them. It has to be the 11th.
The evening before her mother left for Pittsburgh, Lexi called Pearl.
"I need a favor," she said.
Her voice dropped halfway to a whisper, even though they were on the line only she and Tripp shared, and Tripp was out. Pearl, still wary after the Halloween party, sighed.
"What?" she said.
In her mind, she ran through the list of things Lexi, of all people, might want. None of the usual things applied. To borrow a top? To borrow lipstick? Pearl had nothing that Lexi Richardson would ever need to use.
To ask her advice?
Lexi never asked anyone's advice. Lexi was the one who dispensed advice, whether it had been asked for or not.
"I need you," Lexi said, "to come with me to this clinic tomorrow. I'm getting an abortion."
There was a long moment of silence while Pearl struggled to process this information. Lexi was pregnant?
A flash of selfish panic shot through her. She and Tripp had been at Tim Michaels just that afternoon. Had they been careful enough? What about the last time? She tried to reconcile what Lexi was saying with a Lexi she knew. Lexi wanted an abortion? Baby crazy Lexi, quick to judge others Lexi. Lexi, who'd been so unforgiving about BB's mistakes. How come you're not asking Serena? She said at last. Lexi hesitated. I don't want Serena, she said. I want you. She sighed. I don't know. I thought you'd understand more. I thought you wouldn't judge. Pearl, despite everything, felt a tingle of pride. I'm not judging, she said. Look, said Lexi, I need you. Are you going to help me or not? At 7:30 a.m., Lexi pulled up in front of the house on Winslow. True to her promise, Pearl was waiting at the curb. She told her mother that Lexi was giving her a ride to school. Are you sure about this? She asked. She had spent the night imagining what she would do in Lexi's situation, every time feeling that flash of panic surge through her again from her scalp to the soles of her feet. It would stay with her until the following week when she would feel cramps beginning and sigh in relief. Lexi did not look away from the windshield. I'm sure. It's a big decision, you know? Pearl tried to think of an analogy she was sure Lexi would understand. You can't take it back. It's not like buying a sweater. I know. Lexi slowed as they approached a traffic light, and Pearl noticed dark rings beneath her eyes. She had never seen Lexi look so tired or so serious. You didn't tell anyone, did you? Lexi asked as the car eased into motion again. Of course not. Not even Moody? Pearl thought of the lie she told Moody last night, that she couldn't walk to school with him as usual because she had a dentist appointment that morning. He hadn't seemed suspicious. It had never occurred to him that Pearl might lie. She'd been relieved, but also a little hurt, that over and over again he'd believed her so easily, that he didn't think her capable of anything but the truth. I haven't told him anything, she said. The clinic was an unassuming beige building with clean, shiny windows, flowering shrubs in front, a parking lot. You could be there to have your eyes checked, to meet your insurance agent, to have your taxes done. Lexi pulled into a spot at the edge of the lot and handed the keys to Pearl. Here, she said. You'll need to drive back. You have your temp on you? Pearl nodded and refrained from reminding her that technically, the temporary permit allowed her to drive only with a licensed adult over 21. Lexi's fingers on the keys were white and cold, and on a sudden impulse, Pearl took Lexi's hand in hers. It'll all be fine, she said, and together they went into the clinic, where the doors slid open as if they were expected. The nurse at the desk was a stout woman with copper-colored hair, who looked at the two girls with benign sympathy. She must see this every day, Pearl thought. Girls coming in terrified at what's about to happen. Terrified about what will happen if they don't. Do you have an appointment, honey? The woman asked. She looked from Pearl to Lexi pleasantly. I do, Lexi said. 8 o'clock. The woman tapped at her keyboard. And your name? Quietly, as if she were ashamed, as if it were really her name, Lexi said, Pearl Warren. It was all Pearl could do to keep her mouth from dropping open. Lexi studiously avoided her eyes as the woman consulted her screen. Do you have someone to drive you home? I do, Lexi said. She tipped her head toward Pearl, again without meeting her eyes. My sister's here. She'll drive me home. Sisters, Pearl thought. They looked nothing alike, she and Lexi. No one would ever believe that she, small, frizzy-haired, was related to willowy, sleek Lexi. It would be like saying a Scottish terrier and a greyhound were litter-mates. The woman glanced at them quickly. After a moment, she either seemed to find this plausible or decided to pretend she did. Go ahead and fill these out, she said, handing Lexi a clipboard of pink forms. They'll be ready for you in a few minutes. When they were safely settled into the chairs farthest from the desk,
Pearl leaned over the clipboard. I cannot believe you are using my name, she hissed.
Lexi slumped in her chair.
I panicked, she said. When I called, they asked for my name, and I remembered that my mom knows the director here.
And you know, my dad's been in the news, the whole case with the McCulloughs. I didn't want them to recognize my name. I just said the first name that came into my head, which was yours.
Pearl was unappeased. Now they all think I'm the one who's pregnant.
It's just a name, Lexi said. I'm the one in trouble, even if they don't know my real name.
She took a deep breath, but seemed to deflate further. Even her hair, Pearl noticed, seemed lank, falling in front of her face so it half covered her eyes.
You could be anyone.
Oh, for God's sake, Pearl took the clipboard from Lexi's lap. Give me those.
She began to fill out the forms, starting with her own name, Pearl Warren. She had almost finished when the door at the end of the waiting room opened and a nurse dressed in white stepped out.
Pearl? She said, checking the file folder in her hands. We're ready for you.
On the line for emergency contact, Pearl quickly jotted down her own mother's name and their home phone number.
Here, she said, thrusting the clipboard into Lexi's hands. Done.
Lexi stood slowly, like a person in a dream. For a moment they stood there, each clasping an end of the clipboard, and Pearl was sure she could feel Lexi's heart pounding all the way down her fingertips and into the wood of the clipboard's back.
Good luck, she said softly to Lexi.
Lexi nodded and took the forms, but at the doorway stopped to look back, as if to make sure Pearl were still there. The look in her eyes said, Please, please, I don't know what I'm doing. Please be here when I get back. Pearl fought the urge to run up and take her hand, to follow her down the hallway, as if they really were sisters. The kind of girls who would see each other through this kind of ordeal. The kind of girls who, years later, would hold each other's hands during childbirth. The kind of girls unfazed by each other's nakedness and pain, who had nothing in particular to hide from one another.
Good luck, she said again, louder this time.
And Lexi nodded and followed the nurse through the door. At the same time that her daughter was changing into her hospital gown, Mrs. Richardson was ringing the doorbell of Mr. and Mrs. George Wright. She had driven the 3 hours to Pittsburgh in one swoop, without even stopping to use the restroom or stretch her legs. Was she really doing this, she wondered? She was not completely certain what she would say to these Wrights, nor what information, precisely, she hoped to obtain from them. But there was a mystery here, she knew, and she was equally sure the Wrights held the key to it. She had traveled for stories a few times in the past, down to Columbus, to investigate state budgeting cuts. Up to Ann Arbor, when a former Shaker student had started at quarterback in the Michigan-OSU game. It was no different, she told herself. It was justified. She had to find out, in person. If Mrs. Richardson had had any doubts about whether she'd found the right family, they were dispelled as soon as the door opened. Mrs. Wright looked strikingly like Mia. Her hair was a bit lighter, and she wore it cut short, but her eyes and face resembled Mia's enough that Mrs. Richardson glimpsed what Mia would look like in 30 years. "Mrs. Wright," she began, "I'm Elena Richardson. I'm a reporter for a newspaper in Cleveland." Mrs. Wright's eyes were narrow and wary. "Yes?" "I'm writing a feature about promising teen athletes whose careers were cut short. I'd like to talk to you about your son." "About Warren?" Surprise and suspicion flashed across Mrs. Wright's face, and Mrs. Richardson could see the two emotions wrestling there. "Why?" "I came across his name while I was researching," she said carefully. "Several stories said he was the most promising teen running back they'd seen in decades, that he had a shot at going pro." "Some scouts came to watch their games," Mrs. Wright said. "They said a lot of nice things about him after he died." A long, quiet moment passed, and when she looked up again, The suspicion had faded away and was replaced by a look of weathered pride.
Well, I guess you can come in.
Mrs. Richardson had planned out this beginning and trusted her instincts to lead the conversation in the direction she wanted it to go. Getting information out of interviewees, she had learned over the years, was sometimes like walking a large, reluctant cow. You had to turn the cow onto the right path while letting the cow believe it was doing the steering. But the rights, it turned out, were unexpectedly easy subjects. Over mugs of coffee and a plate of Pepperidge Farm cookies, the rights seemed almost eager to talk about Warren.
"I'm just interested in keeping his memory alive," she said.
And as soon as she began to ask questions, the gush of information that poured out of them was almost more than she could write down. Yes, Warren had been the starting running back on the football team. Yes, he'd been a forward on the hockey team as well. He'd started with Pee-wee when he was 7 or 8. Would Mrs. Richardson like to see some photos? He'd just had a natural gift for sports. They hadn't trained him. No, Mr. Wright had never been much good at sports himself. More of a watcher, he would say, than a player. But Warren had been different. He just had a talent for it. His coach had said he might make a Division I school if he trained hard enough. If the accident hadn't happened. Here, Mr. and Mrs. Wright both fell silent for a moment. And Mrs. Richardson, curious as she was to learn more, felt a pang of true pity. She looked down at the photograph of Warren Wright in his football uniform, which Mrs. Wright had pulled from the mantel to show her. He must have been 17 then, just the same age as Tripp. They didn't look much alike, the two boys, but something in the pose reminded her of her son. The tilt of the head, the mischievous trace of a smirk at the corners of the lips. "He was quite a heartbreaker," she murmured, and Mrs. Wright nodded. "I've got children myself," Mrs. Richardson found herself saying, "and a boy around that age. I'm so sorry." "Thank you." Mrs. Wright gave the photo one last long look, then set it back on the mantel and angled it carefully, wiped a speck of dust from the glass. This woman, Mrs. Richardson thought, had endured so much. Part of her wanted to close her notebook and cap her pen and thank her for her time. But she hesitated, remembering why she'd come. If it had been her daughter who had run off and lied about who she was, she told herself, if it had been her daughter who'd stirred up trouble for well-meaning people, well, she wouldn't blame anyone for asking questions. Mrs. Richardson took a deep breath. "I was hoping to speak to Warren's sister as well," she said, and pretended to consult her notes. "Mia, would you be willing to give me her current phone number?" Mr. and Mrs. Wright exchanged uneasy looks, as she had known they would. "I'm afraid we've been out of contact with our daughter for some time," Mrs. Wright said. "Oh dear, I'm so sorry," Mrs. Richardson glanced from one parent to the other. "I hope I haven't broached a taboo subject." She waited, letting the uneasy silence grow. No one, she had learned from experience, could stand such silence for long. If you waited long enough, someone would start talking, and more often than not, they would give you a chance to press further, to crack the conversation open and scoop out what you needed to know. "Not exactly," Mr. Wright said after a moment. "But we haven't spoken with her since shortly after Warren died."
"How sad," Mrs. Richardson said.
"That happens quite a lot. One family member taking a loss very hard, dropping out of contact." "But what happened with Mia had nothing to do with what happened to Warren," Mrs. Wright broke in. "What happened with Warren was an accident, teenage boys being reckless. Or maybe just the snow. Mia, well, that's a different story. She was an adult. She made her own choices. George and I..." Mrs. Wright's eyes welled up. "We didn't part on the best terms," put in Mr. Wright. "That's terrible," Mrs. Richardson leaned closer. "That must have been so hard for you both, to lose both of your children at once, in a way." "What choice did she give us?" Mrs. Wright burst out. Showing up in that state.
Regina, Mr. Wright said, but Mrs. Wright did not stop. I told her I didn't care how nice these Ryan people were. I didn't approve of it. I didn't think it was right to sell your own child.
Mrs. Richardson's pencil froze in midair.
Pardon?
Mrs. Wright shook her head.
She thought she could just give it up and go on with her life, like nothing had happened. I had two children, you know. I knew what I was talking about, even before we lost Warren.
She pinched the bridge of her nose, as if there were a mark there that she wanted to rub out.
You don't ever get over that, saying goodbye to a child. No matter how it happens, that's your flesh and blood.
Mrs. Richardson's head was spinning. She set her pencil down.
Let me see if I have this right, she said. Mia was pregnant and was planning to let this couple, the Ryans, adopt her baby?
Mr. and Mrs. Wright exchanged looks again, but this time the look between them said, in for a penny. It was clear to Mrs. Richardson's practiced eye that they wanted to talk about it, that perhaps they had been waiting to talk to someone about it for a long, long time.
Not exactly, Mr. Wright said. There was a long pause. Then, it was their baby, too. They couldn't have their own. She was carrying it for them.
13. In the fall of 1980, Mia Wright, just turned 18, left the little yellow house in Bethel Park for the New York School of Fine Arts. She had never been outside of Pennsylvania before, and she left home with two suitcases and her brother's love and without her parents' blessing. She had not told her parents she was applying to art school until the acceptance letter had arrived. It was not wholly unexpected, or should not have been. As a child, she had been fascinated by things that, to her bemusement, no one else seemed to even notice.
"You are such a wool gatherer," her mother would say. "You sat in your stroller just staring out at the lawn. You'd sit in the tub and pour water back and forth from one cup to another for an hour if I'd let you."
What Mia remembered of those moments was watching the blades of grass in the breeze, changing color as they went, from dark to light, like the nap of velvet when you brushed your hand over it. The way the stream of water broke itself into droplets as it splashed against the cup's rim. Everything, she noticed, seemed capable of transmogrification. Even the two boulders in the backyard sometimes turned to silver in the early morning sunlight. In the books she read, every stream might be a river god, every tree a dryad in disguise, every old woman a powerful fairy, every pebble an enchanted soul. Anything had the potential to transform, and this, to her, seemed the true meaning of art. Only her brother, Warren, seemed to understand the hidden layers she saw in things. But then they had always had an understanding, since before he had been born.
"My baby," Mia would say to anyone who would listen, tapping her mother's belly with a finger. And infallibly, Warren would kick in reply. "My baby. In there," she informed strangers in the grocery store, pointing.
When they'd brought him home from the hospital, she had immediately claimed him as her own.
"My Wren," she'd called him, not only because Warren had been too long to pronounce, but because it suited him.
Even in those early days, he'd looked like a vigilant chick, head tipped to one side, two impossibly bright and focused eyes searching the room for her. When he cried, she knew which toy would calm him. When he wouldn't nap, Mia lay next to him in the center of their parents' bed, blankets heaped around them in a chenille nest, singing him songs and patting his cheek until he dozed. When he fell, skinning the cat on the monkey bars, it was Mia he ran crying for, and Mia who dabbed the gash on his temple with iodine and stuck a bandage across it.
"You'd think she was the mother," their mother had said once, half in tones of complaint, half in admiration.
They had their own words for things, a jargon of obscure origin. For reasons even they had forgotten, they referred to butter as cheese. They called the grackles that perched in the treetops icklebirds.
It was a circle they drew around the two of them like a canopy.
"Don't tell anyone from France," Mia would begin before whispering a secret. And Warren's reply was always, "Wild giraffes couldn't drag it out of me."
And then, at 11, almost 12, Mia discovered photography. Warren, just turned 10, had himself discovered not only sports, but that he was good at them. Baseball in the summer, football in the fall, hockey in the winter, basketball in all the spaces in between. He and Mia were still close, but there were long afternoons at the baseball diamond in the park, long hours practicing passes and practicing layups. So it was natural that Mia, too, would find a passion of her own. At the junk shop in town, she spotted an old brownie Starflex sitting in the corner of the front window. The camera had lost its flash and neck strap, but the shop owner assured her it would work. And as soon as Mia flipped up the little silver hood and saw the junk shop reflected in blurry miniature in the lens, she wanted it immensely. She dipped into the cat-shaped bank where she saved her allowance and began to carry the camera everywhere. She ignored the manual suggestion that she write the Kodak Company for its helpful book, How to Make Good Pictures, and went by instinct alone. With a camera dangling from two of her mother's old silk scarves knotted together, she began to take photos. Odd photos, to her parents' eyes. Run-down houses, rusted-out cars, objects discarded on the side of the road.
"Funny thing to be taking a picture of," the clerk at the photomat remarked as he handed over an envelope of prints.
That set had contained three images, taken over successive days, of a bird's corpse on the sidewalk. And he wondered briefly, not for the first time, if the right girl was a little touched in the head. For Mia, however, the photographs were only a vague approximation of what she wanted to express. And she soon found herself not only altering the prints, with everything from ballpoint pen to splashes of laundry detergent, but experimenting with the camera itself, bending its limited range to her desires. The Starflex, like all brownies, allowed no focusing. The shuttle cocked automatically to avoid double exposures, which the manual billed as a convenience for the amateur. All you had to do was all that you could do: peek into the viewfinder and press the shutter. Instead of holding the camera level against her chest, per the instructions, Mia tipped it at different angles, knotted her makeshift straps higher or lower. She draped silk scarves and wax paper over the lens. She tried shooting in fog, in heavy rain, in the smoke-filled lounge of the bowling alley.
"Waste of money," her mother sniffed, when Mia brought home yet another envelope of blurred and grainy photos.
With each roll of film, however, she began to understand more and more how a photograph was put together, what it could do and what it could not, just how far you could stretch and twist it. Though she did not know it at the time, all of this was training her to be the photographer she would become. With only 12 exposures on a roll, she learned to be careful in composing her shots. And with no controls, no aperture control, no focus, she learned to be creative in the way she manipulated her camera and her scene. At this moment, fortuitously, their neighbor, Mr. Wilkinson, intervened. He lived up the hill from them, and for some time he'd seen Mia with her brownie wandering the neighborhood, snapping pictures of this and that. Mia and Warren know only one thing about Mr. Wilkinson. He was a toy buyer and spent most of his time traveling to toy shows, perusing merchandise, sending reports to headquarters on which toys to stock. Every few months, Mrs. Wilkinson would round up the neighborhood children and distribute the sample toys Mr. Wilkinson had accumulated. Marvelous toys they were. A set of molds that you filled with plaster to cast Christmas ornaments. A Saturn-shaped ball on which you could bounce, pogo style. A giant doll's head with hair of gold to quaff. A box of perfumes to blend and pinky-sized vials to hold your concoctions.
"I need my basement back," she'd said, laughing, making sure each child got something, even if only a yo-yo.
The Wilkinson son was grown by then, living somewhere in Maryland, and no longer needed toys. For a long time, this was the only image Mia had of Mr. Wilkinson, a mysterious cross between Marco Polo and Santa Claus, who filled his home with treasures. But one afternoon, just after her 13th birthday, Mr. Wilkinson had called to her sternly from his front porch.
"I've been seeing you traipsing around for a year now," he'd said. "I want to see what you've been up to."
Mia, terrified, collected a stack of her photographs and brought them to the Wilkinsons the next morning. She had never shown her photos to anyone but Warren before, and Warren, of course, had oohed and aahed. But Mr. Wilkinson was an adult, a man she barely knew. He would have no incentive to be kind. When she rang the Wilkinsons' doorbell, Mrs. Wilkinson led her into the den, where Mr. Wilkinson sat at a large desk typing something on a cream-colored typewriter. But when Mia entered, he swiveled around in his chair and swung the typewriter shelf down and under, where it folded into a cabinet in the desk as neatly as if it had been swallowed.
"Now then," he said.
He unfolded a pair of half-moon glasses that hung around his neck and placed them on his nose, and Mia's knees trembled.
"Let's have a look."
Mr. Wilkinson, it turned out, was a photographer himself, though he preferred landscapes.
"Don't like shots with people in them," he told her. "I'll take a tree over a person any day."
When he went on a trip, he took his camera with him and always scheduled himself half a day to go exploring. From a file, he pulled a stack of photographs, a redwood forest at dawn, a river snaking through a field shot with dew, a lake reflecting the sun in a glittering triangle that pointed to the woods beyond. The photographs all over the hallway, Mia realized, were his as well.
"You've got a good eye," Mr. Wilkinson said at last. "Good eye and good instincts. See this one here?"
He tapped the top picture, a photo of Warren perched in the low branches of a sycamore, back to the camera, silhouetted against the sky.
"That's a fine shot.
How'd you know how to frame that?"
"I don't know," Mia admitted. "It just looked right."
Mr. Wilkinson squinted at another.
"Hold on to that. Trust your eyes. They see well."
He plucked out another photo.
"But see this? You wanted that squirrel, didn't you?"
Mia nodded. It had been running along the ridge of the fence, and she'd been mesmerized by the undulating arc its body and tail had traced as it ran. Like watching a ball bounce, she'd thought as she clicked the shutter. But the photo had come out blurry, focused on the fence instead of the squirrel itself simply a smudge. She wondered how Mr. Wilkinson knew.
"Thought so. You need a better camera. That one's fine for a starter or for birthday parties and Christmas. Not for you."
He went to the closet and rummaged in the back, the old overcoats and bagged dresses inside muffling his voice.
You want to take real pictures."
In a moment, he returned and held out a compact box.
"You need a real camera, not a toy."
It was a Nikon F, a little silver and black thing, heavy and solid in her hands. Mia ran her fingers over the pebbled casing.
"But I can't take this."
"I'm not giving it. I'm lending it. You want it or not?"
Without waiting for her to answer, Mr. Wilkinson opened a drawer in his desk.
"I'm not using that one anymore. Someone might as well."
He removed a black canister of film and tossed it to Mia.
"Besides," he said, "I'm looking forward to seeing what you do with it."
By the time Mia went home that afternoon, she had learned how to wind the film onto the spool inside the camera, how to focus it, how to adjust the lens. Strange and beguiling new words swirled in her head. F-stop. Aperture. Over and over again, she lifted the camera to her eye to peer through the viewfinder. Under the hairline cross at its center, everything was transformed. Mr. Wilkinson taught her how to extract the film from its roll and develop it, and Mia came to love the sharp bite of the developer, how to watch for the sheen of silver on the film's surface that told her it was ready. Like a pilot dipping the plane into a tailspin to practice pulling back out, She would deliberately take photos out of focus with the wrong shutter speed or the wrong ISO to see what happened. She learned how to control the light and the camera to get the effects she wanted, like a musician learning the intricacies of an instrument.
"But how can you,"
she would ask, watching the print form on the paper and comparing it to the image she'd had in her mind. At first, Mr. Wilkinson would know the answer.
"Dodging. Use a diffused bright fill. Let's try freelensing."
But soon her questions became more advanced, sending him to the copy of Photographic Techniques he kept on the bookshelf.
"The young lady wants a greater depth of field," he mused one afternoon. By now, Mia was 15. "What the young lady needs is a view camera."
Mia had never heard of such a thing, but soon all her earnings, from clerking at Dixon's Pharmacy to waitressing at the Eaton Park, were earmarked for a camera, and she spent hours poring over Mr. Wilkinson's camera catalogs and photography magazines.
"You spend more time reading those things than you do taking pictures," Mr. Wilkinson teased her.
But she eventually settled on one, the Graphic View 2, and even Mr. Wilkinson couldn't dispute her choice.
"That's a solid camera," he said. "Good value for your money. You take care of that. It'll be with you your whole life."
And when the Graphic View 2 arrived, procured secondhand from a classified ad, well-loved and packed into its own case like an expensive violin, Mia knew this would be true. To her parents, the camera was less impressive.
"You spent how much on that?"
her mother asked, while her father shook his head. It looked to them like something from the Victorian era, balanced on a spindly tripod with a pleated belly like a bellows and a dark cloth that Mia ducked underneath. She tried to explain to them how it worked, but at the first mention of shifts and tilts, their attention began to wander. Even her beloved Warren gave up at that point.
"I don't need to know how it works, me," he told her at last. "I just want to see the pictures."
And Mia realized that she was crossing into a place she would have to go alone. She took pictures of the jungle gym at the local park, of streetlights at night, of city workers chopping down an oak that had been struck by lightning. She lugged the view camera downtown to photograph a rusty bridge stretching over the spot where the three rivers collided. By toying with the settings, she took a picture of Warren's football game from up in the bleachers, where the players looked like miniatures, the kind you'd see on a train set.
"That's me," Warren had said,
peering at one of the figures, the one long in the end zone waiting for the pass.
"That's you, Ren," Mia said.
She had a sudden image of herself as a sorceress, waving her hand over the field and transforming the boys below into pea-sized plastic dolls. She took that print to Mr. Wilkinson's the next day, only to find a strange woman at the door. Mr. Wilkinson's daughter-in-law, it turned out.
"Della passed in her sleep," the daughter-in-law told her, eyeing Mia, the camera around her neck, the photograph in her hand. "What did you say you needed?"
After the funeral, the daughter-in-law and her husband convinced Mr. Wilkinson to move into a retirement home in Silver Spring, nearer to them. It happened so quickly, Mia did not even have the chance to say goodbye, let alone show him the photograph. And she and her camera were alone again. In the fall of 1979, her senior year of high school, Mia applied to the New York School of Fine Arts with a series of photographs she'd taken of abandoned buildings around town. She'd dabbed the prints with a damp cloth, and while the emulsion was wet, used the tip of a needle to scrape away the image, leaving a pin-thin white line. The results were a kind of reverse scrimshaw, a spectral worker slumped on the steps outside a shuttered factory. The outline of a sedan atop the empty hydraulic lift of Jameson's auto repair. A pair of phantom children scrambling hand in hand up a hill of slag. At the sight of those children, Warren had squinted and peered closer. The two children could have been anyone, but they weren't anyone. There was the little cowlick at the crown of Warren's head. There was a knotted silk scarf around Mia's neck, the weight of the camera pulling her slightly askew. There were no pictures of the two of them doing such a thing, but it seemed to them they'd spent their childhoods playing on the slag heaps that butted up against the park, and looking at his sister's photograph, Warren felt as if Mia had taken a photo of the ghosts of their past selves, about to fade into the ether. "When you get it back, can I have it?" he'd asked. To her parents, the photos, and Mia's work in general, were less enchanting. They did not even call what she did work or art, which in their minds would have been just as bad. They were middle-class people, had lived all their married lives in a butter-colored middle-class ranch house in a stolid middle-class town. To them, work was fixing something or making something useful. If it didn't have a use, they couldn't quite make out why you'd do it. Art was something that people with too much time and money on their hands did. Could you blame them? Her father was a handyman, founder and sole proprietor of Wright's Repair. One day working at the church repairing the eaves where a board had broken and a family of squirrels had wriggled their way into the nave. Another day at a neighbor's house, snaking the drains or replacing a U-bend under the sink that had rusted away. Her mother was a nurse at the hospital, counting pills, drawing blood, changing bedpans, no stranger to night and double shifts. They worked with their hands. They worked long hours. They saved all they could and put it into a paid-off house and two Buicks and their two children, whom they were proud to say, accurately, lacked for nothing but were never spoiled. But there was Mia, sprawled on the floor for hours, taking a perfectly good picture of Warren and cutting him out like a paper doll, setting up her cutout brother in a diorama of leaves in an old shoebox, all for one photograph, in which Warren looked like an elf surrounded by giant acorns. Clever, but it hardly seemed worth the time she'd put in. There was Mia the second her father got home, his shoes barely off and the grease not yet washed from his hands, begging for $2 for more film, promising, "I'll pay it back, I promise." The truth be told, she seldom did. There was Mia, who, when her mother gave her money for new school clothes, patched the holes in her old jeans instead and spent the money on yet more film, running around in skirts that were inches too short, shirts that were faded and worn, taking yet more pictures. There was Mia, who, when she went out and got a job as a waitress at the Eaton Park, instead of using her earnings to buy her own clothes or a used car, saved them and spent everything on a camera, of all things. It wasn't even a camera the rest of them could use. She'd tried to explain to them once about movement and lens distance, and they'd all lost interest almost at once. Though she did take a family portrait of the four of them, her senior year of high school, that her mother had framed and hung on the living room wall. The camera folded down into a valise the size of a briefcase, and somehow this made it even more disappointing to her parents. All that money, packed away into such a small space. How could you blame Mia's parents for not understanding? They had been born in the wartime years. They'd been raised by parents who'd come of age in the Depression, who threw nothing out, not even moldy food. They were old enough to remember when rags became felt for the war effort, when cans and scrap metal could become bullets and cans of grease explosives. Practicality was baked into their bones. They wasted nothing, especially not time. So when it came to college, they had assumed she would go somewhere practical, like Pitt, or perhaps Penn State, to study something like business or hotel management. They had assumed this photography thing was an adolescent phase, like boy chasing or vegetarianism. What else had they worked so hard for all these years? For Mia to throw their money away on art school? No. If she wanted art school so badly, she would have to pay her own way. It wasn't mean, they insisted. It was sensible. They weren't forbidding her from going. They were not angry, they assured her. Certainly not. Definitely not. But they'd sat her down in the living room and put it bluntly. This art thing was a waste of time. They were disappointed in her, and they certainly wouldn't pay for it.
I thought we raised you to be smarter, her mother said, her voice laced with disapproval.
Mia had listened sadly, but it was what she'd expected. She had known all along her parents would not approve. All this time they had indulged her hobby, but now that she was 18, she knew things would be different. She was supposed to be an adult, when childish indulgences were supposed to be set aside, not dived into head first. She had already done a series of calculations, and if her parents had agreed to contribute at all, she would have been taken aback. The school had been so impressed by her portfolio that they'd offer her a tuition scholarship. Her room and board and supplies, she estimated, she would pay for with a part-time job. Her parents glanced at each other, as if they'd known all along their threat wouldn't work, and absorbed this news in silence. The week before Mia was to leave, Warren appeared in the doorway of her room. "Me, I've been thinking," he said. So seriously, she almost giggled until he reached into his back pocket and pulled out a folded stack of bills. "I think you should take this. It won't pay for all the rest, but it'll be most of it."
"And the car, Ren?" she asked.
Warren had been saving up to buy a car, had even, after much research, picked out the very car he planned to buy, a Volkswagen Rabbit. It was not the car she'd have expected from him. She'd have guessed a Trans Am or a Thunderbird, something flashy and fun. But gas was running $1.10 a gallon. And not only was the Rabbit one of the few cars he could afford, the ads promised it would get 38 miles per gallon as well. And she was amused to see this practical side of Warren emerging here, of all places. She folded his hand over the bills and pushed it gently away. "Go get that car, Ren," she said. "Get it, and promise to pick me up at the bus station whenever I come home." Mia had boarded a Greyhound to Philly, then New York, with one suitcase of clothing and one of cameras. From a bulletin board, she'd found an apartment in the Village, not far from campus, with two other girls. She'd gotten a job as a waitress at a little diner near Grand Central, and another at the Dick Blick in Soho. With the last of her savings, she'd headed over to the photography store on West 17th, where a young man sold her film and paper as she tried not to stare at his yarmulke. Thus equipped, she'd begun her classes. Figure drawing 1. Light and color 1. Survey of art 1. Introduction to critical studies. And, with the most excitement, introduction to photography, taught by the renowned Pauline Hawthorne. It turned out that despite their best intentions, her parents had prepared her exceptionally well for art school. Each morning, she got up at 4:30 and went to work pouring coffee for businessmen about to catch their trains. The hot plates she carried from the kitchen seared the insides of her forearms with arc-shaped scars. Her mother had always managed, even on her double shifts, to make each patient more than a body in a bed, chatting with them about their daughter's dance recital or their brother's recent car trouble, asking after their pets. And watching her for years, Mia had learned this talent too, remembering who took cream and sugar, who liked ketchup on their eggs, who always left the crust on the edge of the plate and was delighted to find next time that she'd had the crusts cut off in the kitchen. She learned to anticipate people's needs, just as her mother knew when to appear with the next dose of morphine or to empty the bedpan. She learned to appear with a coffee pot just as they were setting down their empty mugs, to watch her customers for the little fidgets and stretches that signaled they were in a hurry and ready for the check, or that they were relaxed and wanted to linger. Because of this, the businessmen and admin liked to sit in her section, and they usually left an extra dollar, or sometimes a 5, on the table. In the kitchen, when the manager wasn't looking, she ate the leftover wedges of toast and cold forkfuls of scrambled eggs from the plates instead of scraping them into the garbage. This was her breakfast. When her shift was over, she changed in the little closet of an employee bathroom, rolling her work uniform and apron into a tight cylinder before tucking it in her knapsack so they would not wrinkle. She did not own an iron, and this way, if she was careful, she could wear the same uniform for a week or more before she had to brave the laundromat. Then in jeans and a t-shirt, she headed to class. From her father, she had learned to change the oil in a car, to wire a socket, to chisel, to saw, which meant she wielded her tools expertly. She knew how far you could flex a piece of wire or a sheet of metal before it broke, how to make clean lines and soft bulges and curves, how to coax a copper pipe into angles and bends. From her mother, she had learned how to handle cloth, from drapey gauze to thick canvas, and how to make it behave, what its limits were, how much you could stretch it, and how much it could hold. How to clean a tool properly, so that no trace of what had touched it remained. Now, in class, when they were asked to make a chair from metal, she already knew how to weld and make things strong. When they were told to work with cloth, she knew, with a quick squeeze of the fabric, how to transform corduroy and linen into a tree, 6 feet tall, that even her teacher would admire. She knew how thin you needed to make paint so that it would flow and how thick you could make it so that it would clump on the canvas like clay, something to be sculpted. In figure drawing, when the model unbelted her robe and let it puddle at her feet, she alone wasted no time blushing but began, immediately, to sketch the model's long limbs and the curve of her breast. At the hospital, helping her mother, she had seen too many bodies to be shy about anything. At 3 o'clock, after her classes ended, she went to work again. Twice a week she had shifts at the Dick Blick, selling art supplies to her fellow students, or restocking the back room. She talked art with the older students, and they told her what they were working on, why they preferred knife to brush, or acrylic to oil, or Fujicolor to Kodachrome. In the back room, her boss, who had a daughter about Mia's age and thus had a soft spot for this girl, working multiple jobs to pay her rent, allowed her to keep the pencils and pastels that had snapped in transit, the paint tubes that had leaked, the brushes and canvases that had been dinged or come unstapled. Anything that could no longer be sold, Mia took home and repaired, restretching the canvases or mending them on the back with tape, sanding the splintered handle of a brush, sharpening 2 half pencils to use in place of a hole. In this way, she was able to acquire a good portion of her supplies for free. 3 evenings a week, Mia boarded the one and rode to 116th Street, where she put on a different uniform and waited tables at a bar near Columbia. The undergrads she served tended to be either haughty and obnoxious or leering and obnoxious, more so as the night wore on, but they tipped her, and at the end of a good night she might have $30 or $40 in her apron. She ate the last bites of their burgers and their forgotten fries and the stubs of their pickles for dinner and folded all the cash into her jeans pocket. She scraped her way through the first year with some money saved even after her rent was paid. Now and then when she called home, for she did call home, she and her parents all insisted there was no ill will between them. They asked politely how school was doing and showed, or at least feigned, interest in her answers. Marin asked if it was worth it. He had always been the happy-go-lucky one, ready to take things as they came. She had been the driven one, the ambitious one, the planner. "It's worth it," she assured him. And she would tell him about her classes, what paintings she'd studied that week, and her favorite, the real reason she woke at 4:30 every morning and stayed up late every night. Photography. When she spoke of Pauline Hawthorne, her tone was half the adoration of a schoolgirl for a crush, half the adoration of a devotee for a saint. It had not been clear, at first, that it would turn out that way. On the first day of photography class, the students had sat upright at their desks, each with a 35mm camera and 2 notebooks, as specified by the supplies list, in hand. When class began, Pauline strode to the back of the room, flicked off the lights, and without introducing herself, clicked on the slide projector. A Man Ray photograph burst onto the screen before them. A voluptuous woman, her back transformed into a cello by 2 painted F-holes. Complete silence filled the room. After 5 minutes, Pauline twitched her thumb and the cello woman was replaced by an Ansel Adams landscape. Mount McKinley glowering over a lake of pure white. No one said anything. Another click. A Dorothea Lange portrait of a Dust Bowl woman. Her dark hair in a deep part, the merest hint of a smile lifting the corners of her lips. For the entire 2 hours of the class, this continued. A survey of photographs they all recognized, but which, as Pauline must have realized, they had never spent much time looking at. Mia, from her reading at the library, recognized them all, but found that after she'd stared at them for long enough, they took on new contours, like faces of people she loved. After the 2 hours had passed, Pauline clicked the slide projector off and the class sat blinking in the sudden brightness. "Next class, bring the photo you're proudest of," she said and left the room. They were the first and only words she'd said. The next class, after much thought, Mia had brought one of the photos she'd taken with her large format camera. Introduction to photography focused on handheld cameras, but Pauline had said, "The photo you're proudest of." And this was hers. A shot of her brother playing street hockey in their backyard, their house and the rest of their neighborhood spread out behind them like miniatures. She had climbed all the way to the top of the hill behind their house to take it. On entering, they found index cards with each student's name pinned up on the walls around the classroom, with clips fastened below them. At 2 minutes past the hour, Pauline entered, again, without introducing herself, and the class gathered beside each photo in turn, Pauline commenting on the composition or the technique of the picture, students timidly answering her questions about point of view or tone. Some were carefully constructed scenes. One or two had attempted something artistic, a silhouette of a girl backlit by an enormous movie screen, a close-up of a tangled telephone cord wrapped around a receiver. Mia and the rest of her classmates had braced themselves against Pauline's questioning. After that first class, they'd been sure she was one of the dragons, as the harsher teachers were known, the ones who delighted in making their students uncomfortable, who thought the best way to push students out of their comfort zones was to bulldoze them into rubble during critiques. But Pauline, it turned out, was no dragon. Despite her no-nonsense air, she found something in each photograph to highlight and praise. It was why, despite being well-established, she chose to teach the beginning students. "Look at how the little sister is laughing here," she said, tapping one of the family portraits. "She's the only one not looking at the camera, which gives you a sense that there's something outside the frame. Is she a rebel? Or does this hint at the whole family's spirit? Or notice how the skyscraper here looks like it's about to pierce the moon. That's a thoughtful choice of perspective." Even her criticisms, which were as common as her praise, were not what Mia had expected. "Water is hard," she said simply, when someone pointed out that a photo of a waterfall was badly blurred. "Let's suppose this was done on purpose. What effect does it have?" Mia's photograph had been last, and when the class gathered before it, Pauline had paused for a moment, as if taken aback. She had studied it carefully for 2 minutes, 3, 5, and in the silence, the class grew uneasy. "Who's Mia Wright?" she asked finally, and Mia stepped forward. Everyone else took a half step back, as if whatever lightning were about to strike might hit them too. Then Pauline began to ask questions. "Why did you have this line run from right to left? Why did you shift the camera this way? Why did you focus on the hockey stick and not the net?" Mia answered as best she could. She had wanted to capture how small the house and the lawn were in comparison to the hills behind it. She had wanted to show the texture of the grass and the way the blades crushed under her brother's shoes. But at a certain point, as Pauline's questions became more technical, she had become flustered and inarticulate. "The line had just looked right that way. The shift had just looked right that way. The depth of field had just looked right that way." At last, just as the class session ended, Pauline stepped away with a nod. "Bring your cameras next time," she said. "We'll start to take some photos." She picked up her bag and left the room, leaving Mia unsure if she'd just passed or failed utterly. Over the next few classes, Pauline treated Mia just like any other student. They learned to wind film into the camera, how to compose a photo, how to calculate the proper aperture and width, All of this Mia knew already from Mr. Wilkinson's tutelage and her own experimentations over the years. As Pauline explained it, however, her intuitive feelings about how to shape